tells me that he's going to speak concerning Volume 4 as an update and review of Volume 4. So we'll see what...
Thank you, Brother Bill. First of all, we'd like to bring the lovely greetings to the brethren in Wilmington. They actually neglected to vote officially, but officially also we're supposed to take at any time, whether we've been told or not. What we're going to try to do is something rather large. It's difficult to go through the entire fourth volume in an hour. Wouldn't it be nice if we could, though? So we'll just be touching on some of the high points and trying to bring it up to date as we go through a review. This book is entitled, or has been variously entitled, The Day of Vengeance and the Battle of Armageddon. The older version apparently was entitled The Day of Vengeance, but it was changed later on to be The Battle of Armageddon, probably because Armageddon as a subject was a very popular subject in Brother Russell's day. Therefore, in Brother Russell's day, the fourth volume was a very current book. It was very relevant, and it generated a lot of excitement, not only among the brethren, but also in the public. We'd like to preface our remarks by asking a quick question. The church has always had messianic expectations. The feeling that the Lord is coming very shortly or that the end of time is very near. We'd like to ask the question, why would the Lord do that? Why doesn't the Lord correct all these misconceptions? But we think that the main reason is that there is a beneficial effect upon the church for thinking that the Lord is coming soon, or that the end of the world is soon to be here. Primarily because seeing those days, we would think, what manner of persons ought we to be, especially as we see these days approaching? And thus, we could not possibly criticize anybody in the church, and especially not Brother Russell, if at times he may have appeared to have been short-sighted. The Lord did not give him knowledge beyond the date 1914. And we think that that was for a reason, for the benefit of the church at that time. Since that time, however, the fourth volume has fallen into just a little bit of this fallen from favor just a little bit. Many of the brethren consider that this is a boring book. You know, so full of all these long quotations, and it's so out of date. Well, it's interesting. Brother Russell could have changed many of those quotations and some of the things that were in it as late as 1914 and 1916, but he chose not to. We think that one of the reasons is because it stands as a testimonial to the fact that the things that the Lord predicted would happen did happen. He did not have to artificially update it to make it appear as though they were predicting things that now the whole world knew was coming to happen. We think also that this loss of favor is a little bit unfortunate because the fourth volume is a part of the harvest message given to the church in this end of the age. And therefore, we would expect that there is material in it which would be of value to us as Bible students. As we overview the book, what we're going to try to do is review some of the expectations that Brother Russell had for his day and bring them up to date to our day. Some of these things, as we go across them, there'll be no need to update them. Selfishness is selfishness, whether it was in B.C. 2000 or today. But in other cases, we're going to see where some of the pressures and forces that were driving the world to what Brother Russell saw as impending doom in 1914, those forces that were tending towards instability, towards Armageddon, are present today. So we're going to start our considerations by dealing with, of course, the forewords. And the first foreword we're going to deal with is not the very first one that's found in the book. There's two forewords in the fourth volume. But the second foreword, often referred to as the 1912 foreword. One of the points Brother Russell makes in here is that the age is to end in conflagration. And if we are in the end of the age, then we are close to the time of our glorification. And this is said as a manner of encouraging the church, especially in our day. Then much of the rest of the foreword goes into a discussion of Revelation 16, verses 13 to 16, which we'll try to very briefly consider. Of course, going through the whole fourth volume, anything we consider will be briefly. As Revelation 16, 13 to 16, and this is a description of the sixth plague. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils, working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth, and of the whole world, to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place, called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. So we have three types of beings here. A beast, a dragon, and a false prophet. I'm sorry, a dragon, beast, and false prophet. And out of their mouths, collectively, come these three frog-like spirits. What are we talking about? When we're talking about interpretation of Revelation, most Bible students and many Protestants alike also recognize that the dragon is the civil power, particularly of Rome, but it's the civil governments. And in history, it represented the emperors and the kings and princes, this side of the ruling forces of mankind. The beast is the papal system. This would be the Pope and the Ecclesiastics. And of course, they worked together during the Middle Ages to control the world. And then the false prophet. What is the false prophet? In Revelation, it is also styled the image of the beast. Well, what's the beast? It's the papal system. An image of the beast, something like it, is the Protestant systems. In another symbol, the Catholic system is called the mother, and the Protestants are called the daughter. So we have these three systems, papacy, the civil governments, and the Protestant systems, all saying a common message. And it's pictured as a frog. What are some of the characteristics of a frog? I think most brethren are familiar with this particular discussion. First of all, a frog puffs itself up, makes itself very large in the sight of others. A second, probably because of its very large eyes, it affects the appearance of great wisdom. And lastly, despite all that, when it finally utters a sound, what does it do? It croaks. Nothing pleasant about it. It's a croak. So we would see that this is the characteristics of these systems. They puff themselves up. They brag to the world about how great they are. They affect a wise look. We are wise. Look at all the knowledge that we have. But when they finally come down to it, the message that they give out is nothing but vain croaking. We see that this message can be seen in a couple lights. One part of the message is don't question. The churches and the civil governments have always said, don't question our authority or the things that we say. Another thing they say is, there is a divine right of kings. Or to bring it up to modern day vernacular, there is such a thing as executive privilege and authority. You should listen to the president because what he says is good. Period. You're not supposed to pray. And the third thing that they're saying is, we have a status quo that must be maintained, because if we don't maintain it, all we're going to have is ruin, and you don't want that, do you? So we feel that this chapter describes a condition starting in Brother Russell's day and continuing up until today. At some time, there will be a brief triumph where these three forces will get together. But this triumph will be brief, because at that time, the Lord sends his great army to destroy them. And we're not suggesting that the Lord's great army is one of moral or character, has moral or character qualities, but rather they do the work of the Lord. And we'll hopefully get to a little more discussion of the Lord's great army when we discuss one of the later chapters. One of the points Brother Russell makes, though, is that God's side in this battle will be the side of the people, not the rulers. God's side is going to be the side of the people. And therefore, we, the saints at this end of the age, have to be in sympathy, not with the rulers, not with the systems that are, even though it provides us our jobs, our security, but rather we should be in sympathy with the oppressed masses of mankind. Nevertheless, though we're to be in sympathy with them, we're not to take sides in this battle, but we're to sit back on the sidelines, as it were, and watch the development of the two sides of the forces. In this foreword, Brother Russell mentions two features that had yet to be fulfilled. One was had to do with the image of the beast. In Revelation, it mentions that the image of the beast must receive power from the two-horned beast. Now, we're multiplying beasts here. We have the papal beast, Rome. We have the image of the beast. It's the Protestant systems. And we have the two-horned beast. This is the Church of England. They're not exactly Protestant. They're very Catholic. But they're not Catholic either because they broke away from it. However, they have the concept of apostolic succession. And the thought that we have is that the apostolic succession is something of value that is desired by the Protestant denominations. They don't have it. They were separate. They started not from the Catholic system, but through a quirk of fate, the Church of England has apostolic succession. Try as they might, the Catholic Church can't take it away from them. And so at some time in the future, it is expected that the Church of England and Ireland, this two-horned beast, will give some kind of vitalizing power to this image of the beast. This has not yet happened. The second feature yet to be fulfilled is that the Jews had to return in great numbers to Palestine. Is this something that we have seen happen? By all means, and by the Lord's grace, we have seen masses of Jews returning to Palestine. Not that they're godly, but that the land is there and that now the Lord can use it. Let's now go to the later foreword, the very first one in the fourth volume, called the 1916 foreword. This other foreword, I believe, was written in 1912. In this 1916 foreword, of course, World War I was now in progress. Brother Russell makes some comments, a prediction about the war. He says, this war will end with either a lack of food or financial weakness. And his expectation was that it would end with financial weakness. Because of this weakness, the churches and the states would get together, and this would be this reign as a queen, as it were, where the church and state would get together and rule the world. This would be that short reign. However, Babylon would fall. And in reference to Revelation 18, verses 10 and 15, we find that the political kings and the financial kings are going to stand back, far away from Babylon, watching her fall and knowing that the fall of Babylon portends their own fall. In all of this, man's extremity will be God's opportunity. The Lord will allow man to go the full length of his efforts and permit the wreck of society, and then reorganize them under Messiah. We want to make a little note on the war. Brother Russell expected the war to basically fizzle out, and it did not, and we think for a very good reason. It was not yet the time. His expectations, we think, were correct, but it was not yet the time. World War I ended with, well, the Germans fizzled out. The Soviets, the Russians also fizzled out, but that was because of a revolution going on in their country. After the war, there was some small revolution in Germany. There was a little war between the socialists and the communists, but it did not fill Brother Russell's expectation. So that we think that the concept of fizzling out from financial weakness, whatever, is still a future occurrence. It wasn't time then, but it also was not the time for the Lord's people to know it. How would the people have thought in Jesus' day if they'd known it was going to be 1,800 years? Instead, we have in Thessalonians that they thought that maybe it was going to be even now that the Lord was present. The Apostle Paul had to correct them for it. All right, let's get into the book itself. The first chapter is an introductory chapter called The Day of Vengeance. And in this chapter, Brother Russell does make the statement that he is not writing it to arouse mere sensation or to gratify idle curiosity. His point was not to come as a make a big stir in the world, nor for people who are just curious but not willing to change their life about it. It was for the church. And then he goes into a discussion of a picture that's found in Isaiah 63. And it's Isaiah 63, 1 through 6. And we'll read verses 1, 4, and 6. Isaiah 63, 1, 4, and 6. Who is this that cometh from Edom, with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel. traveling in the greatness of his strength. I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Let's read verse 2. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth the winepress? Verse 4. The day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. I'll read verse 3 too. I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury, and their blood will be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. Verse 6. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and make them drunk in my fury, and will bring down their strength in the earth. Of course, Edom here pictures Christendom, Babylon. And the prediction is that Babylon would be fully and completely destroyed. This is the purpose of the day of vengeance, to destroy them. Let's go to chapter 2, the doom of Babylon. That was a quick chapter, wasn't it? This chapter actually has a lot of good scriptural references in it, and we would recommend that the brethren read it on their own. We'd like to bring out just a few points. First of all, literal Babylon had a fall also. And the fall of literal Babylon, with Belshazzar's feast and Cyrus marching into the city, pictures the fall of nominal Babylon. What happens is that there is a judgment. They are weighed in the balances, the mother and daughter systems, and they are found wanting because their character and acts, instead of being that of what the church should have been, were evil. And of course, the note to the church is that you are to flee from out of her and not be a part of her. That's found in Revelation 18, 1 through 5, and also Jeremiah 51, 9, which we will not quote. We as the church, coming down to this day, many of us have not actually fled from Babylon. We were never in Babylon. But there is also another good piece of advice, that we are not to attempt to hide from this day of anger. There are many systems, and we could try to hide in having a good bank account, an IRA, secure finances, the police, or even in a literal cave. We cannot hide in those methods. The only thing we can do is that we must make the Most High our refuge, because everything else is going to be destroyed. Chapter 3, on the necessity and justice of the day of vengeance, is one of those chapters where Brother Russell lays the philosophical foundation as to why should there be this type of a final destruction anyway? Couldn't the Lord just nicely bring in the kingdom? Why does there have to be such a horrible and sudden end? It brings out the fact that the Jewish harvest is a picture of this time also. We find the nation of Israel, they were God's people. God dealt with them. He brought them out of Egypt. He gave them laws, precepts, and what happened? They would fail. So as a father, he would chastise them, bring them back, and they would fail again. And their iniquities grew and grew. So up until the days of Jesus, where they had to be cast off, God said, it is enough. You should have learned from history that I will not tolerate this. But each generation did not. Each person thought in his mind, I'm going to get a little bit of advantage, and I'm going to accrue just a little bit of selfishness to myself. And no one paid attention to history. I guess they all figured that it's not going to come in my time. Therefore, I can get away with it. It's sort of like a wet paint sign. Ever seen one of those wet paint signs? What do you want to do? You want to go up and touch it? What would happen if you put your hand against a wet paint sign? You'd have a messy hand. Should people feel sorry for you because you mess yourself up for disregarding a sign? No, nobody should feel sorry. Maybe they should suggest that you could learn to read or something like that if you couldn't read. But in most cases, a sign is there for a purpose. History is there for us to learn from. And we in our generation have more knowledge of history than any generation preceding us. We should know better. The kings of the earth today, the political leaders, should know better. But they don't. Each one is once again hoping that maybe he can get a little bit of advantage in my time. Maybe it won't come in my time. And the fact that some get away with it, causes others to try it. So it, the effect of sin is progressively downward till it has to end in a calamity. The kings, by their oppression, created the very hatred that eventually rose up to destroy them. The ecclesiastics, the ministers and the churches, were no less responsible, because they, of anybody, should have known better, because they had Christian principles that they should have followed, but they did not. They corrupted themselves with the worldly spirit just as much as anybody else. Even the heathen, those that are not Christian, are not guiltless. The Apostle Paul mentions in Romans 1 that the Gentiles are without excuse. And today, there is so much of a westernizing influence throughout the world that certainly the heathen have the same access to information and knowledge that we do. And therefore, they too are without excuse. We're now going to go into a large portion of the center section of the book, chapters 4 through 10. These chapters contain many quotations, many discussions, and not that much in the way of scriptures. And this is the part of the book that brethren usually look at as, oh, it's boring. It's very tedious, and indeed it can be very tedious. So we might suggest that in our personal studies that we consider chapters 1 through 3 and 11 through the end, I think it's 14, maybe 15, in greater detail, and that we could quickly read over these sections. But we're going to try to pick out some of the high points. What's the point of what Brother Russell was saying? Chapter 4 is a preliminary chapter along this line. It's entitled Babylon Arraigned Before the Great Court. Now, some of you who work in courts know what an arraignment is. It's merely a reading of the crimes. And in this chapter, Brother Russell very quickly goes over some of the sins of the nominal systems. We're going to list them quickly. First of all, the rulers have taken an unfair advantage of their position. Those that have been in power have used their power for the oppression of the masses and the personal benefit of themselves. Secondly, these rulers, both the political and religious, have heralded their status. Look how great we are. Look at the good things we are doing for you. Look at the good things we are doing in this earth. Saying that, therefore, you must consider us. Thirdly, the leaders have been extravagant in the squandering of resources. All the resources of the common people are taken by the leader and spent on vast estates and on vast standing armies. So the national debts, even in Brother Russell's day, were unconscionable. They were so large that all the gold in the world then could not pay the interest. A fourth charge, the rich are wallowing in their luxury while the poor are languishing. We'll get into this a little bit more in chapter 7 in the preparation of the elements. And a fifth charge is that the churches, who have supposedly a higher standard, have been no different than the rest of the world. And in fact, in addition to all these things, they've used the doctrine of hell to try to intimidate people into staying with them. Since Brother Russell's day, has the doctrine of hell fallen into disuse? Among some people, yes, but we find that among fundamentals and evangelicals, the Pentecostals, born again, that the subject of hell is actually a little bit stronger. They believe it's stronger now because they have to fight a little stronger against infidelity and against these groups who don't believe in hell, like us. Even the Jehovah's Witnesses, supposedly descended from the Truth Movement, have substituted the second death for a hellfire. If you don't come with us today, you're going into second death. And it's the same effect. An attempt to intimidate and to bring fear into the people to get them under their control. Chapter 5, Babylon before the Great Court, her confusion, national. This chapter discusses the national distress that the nations were in. And of course, in Brother Russell's day, the main topic of concern was the preparation for war. There seemed to be a general feeling that peace is assured by a preparation for war. And can't you see that in the headlines today? Peace is assured by preparation for war. A good defense brings peace. vast resources at that time of both manpower and money were being poured into standing armies, preparedness, and weapons. We're going to give a couple quotes here. You know, Brother Russell does a lot. And these are not Brother Russell's quotes, but Brother Russell had them in the fourth volume, and we think they're very good. Quote, "Peace is supposed to be guaranteed by fear of war." Isn't this what detente is? The Russians should be so afraid that we're going to blast them off the earth with Star Wars and whatever, that they're not going to start a war. So therefore, the fear of war will keep them from fighting. Another quote. "The very effectiveness of modern weapons makes war improbable." And I think many of us have been amused by the description of how horrible the Gatling gun is, and where it took three men that could, you know, wipe out a whole army. And yet, these early guns in World War I are nothing compared to what we have today. "Did the effectiveness of those modern implements of war, those huge guns that could hurl a shell 75 miles, did that stop war?" I don't think we need to say anything about that. "It is seen in the world that a strong defense for protection is usually seen as a threat by the neighbor. As the Germans build up their armies for self-protection, the French would say, well, they can now overrun us. We're going to have to build up our armies for self-protection. And the Germans look back at the French and say, they're building up their armies. Are they maybe going to try to attack us and defeat us while our backs are turned? Why, we have to build up our arms more. And we end up in an arms race. And interestingly enough, without an arms race, when a war does break out, those countries that have not built up their weapons fall victim first. In World War II, we saw this, that the Germans overran all the weaker countries, even some of the stronger countries. So it becomes necessary to have an arms race. The world can't get out of it. It's a dilemma. We appreciated a point brought out by Brother Paul Malley in one of his talks, that every single arms race that in the history of mankind, he named some thousand number of them, has ended either in war or financial collapse. Every single arms race has ended in war or financial collapse. Will our current arms race be exempt from that? No, it will not. Let's go to Joel 3, 9 through 11. Joel is one of those little books that's hard to find. Oops. Right. Okay. Joel 3, chapter 3, verses 9 through 11. "Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles. Prepare war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves, and come, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. Thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Lord." What do we have here but a description of the fact that at some time, and we're talking about right now, the implements of peace, all the farmer boys, instead of being behind plows, are now behind rifles. They're taking the peaceful things that could be used for good and converting them to war material. What is the result? Verse 12, "Let the heathen be wakened and come to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there will I sit to judge all the heathen round about." And of course, at this time, verse 14, "Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision." We're talking about Armageddon. The whole purpose of the world now, not just little countries in arms race, but the whole world, United States, Soviet Union, China, India, Israel, Pakistan, every single nation wants more weapons, Libya, is going to end in Armageddon, and is preparing us for it. Let's go to chapter 6. Babylon before the great court, her confusion, Ecclesiastical. We discussed a little bit, just a very little bit, about one aspect of the national confusion, the preparation for war, because that's stupidity. Now we're going to consider and ecclesiastical stupidity, and it has to do with basically the ecumenical movement. In this chapter, of course, the crimes of the nominal system are brought up. They have been teaching the precepts of men instead of the truth, and they've gone worldly. They're inconsistent, they lack piety, and they have also failed to convert the world. If they could have converted the world to Christianity, all would have been well. Actually, no. But they've failed in that attempt anyway. And in the face of this, they are striving to come together. There's an effort at ecumenicism, the ecumenical movement, a coming together of the churches. And Brother Russell has in this chapter one of those things that a lot of brethren see, well, gee, what's the point of this? A description of the World Parliament of Religions on pages 181 to 242, 61 pages. What's the World Parliament of Religions? Why is it so prominent? It was a gathering in Chicago in 1893 where the Presbyterians invited representatives of every major religion of the earth to all come together, and they would all present a viewpoint. The idea being ultimately to work out some kind of framework for universal religious affiliation. Well, the effects of this actually were a little bit abortive. It was probably a little bit too early, and it was also on too grand a scale. We're just trying to get the Protestant systems and the Catholic systems together in our thoughts of the ecumenical movement. And here these people were trying to get everybody together. But it was the concept of the idea of let us get together. There's several things that this parliament did. First of all, it introduced heathenism into a greater sphere of influence. It also fostered a mother-daughter cooperation or friendship, a desire for getting together because now forces of Christianity have to combat the forces of heathenism. Even if we work out some kind of common framework, we want to be a little bit on top. A third thing is that it revealed the weaknesses of modern Christianity. Modern Christianity could not stand in the face even of the heathen religion. They were no better, no different. And fourth, it illustrated that union was not a matter of the Lord's will, but a matter of policy. We're getting together for power, not because it's better spiritually, but because it does our systems more good. Let's look at Nahum 1:10. That's another one of those little books. Right after Micah. Just a few pages on. Nahum 1:10. For while they be folded together as thorns, and while they are drunken as drunkards, they shall be devoured as stubble fully dry. This is a description of the churches gathering together, each one being a little thorn. What happens when you fold them all together? Why, you still have a bunch of thorns, and it's a very uncomfortable circumstance. So though the churches will try to get together and unite for common good, it will not work. Currently, in bringing it to today, there are two areas where the ecumenical movement is going very strong. The first is the area of the traditional churches. The mainline denominations have had more overtures for union. And part of the reason is because a lot of these Protestant churches are becoming more Romish. Brother Russell uses the example of the Methodist Church. When the Methodist Church was first created, these were the holy rollers of the day. They were very outspoken and scriptural, and you had your wandering circuit preachers that gave blistering talks on hellfire and need for reform and that. But by Brother Russell's day, they've sort of settled in and gotten a little bit quieter. Well, those are unpopular, and we have to give a little more popular message, a softer message that people find more comfortable. Today, the Methodists are so similar to the Catholics in their ceremonial features that there's not a lot separating them. And most don't really see doctrinal issues anyway. It's interesting, in our class, we have a lot of, Wilmington, we have a lot of ex-Methodists. And we heard that some had gone back to their original church. And even in the time that since they had left, short 10, 15, 20 years ago, that the Methodist Church had adopted so many forms that reminded them of Catholicism that they couldn't believe it. The second area of unity is not among the mainline, but among the evangelicals, the fundamentalists, and the born-again Christians. These are ones that, it doesn't matter what church you go to, I speak in tongues, I heal, and they cross all denominational boundaries, and they form a movement all their own. And we sort of feel, it's our personal opinion, that when the time for actual unity is necessary, the mainline denominations are going to provide the structural framework for an organization. But the driving force behind the unity, the driving force behind the persecution of the church, is not going to come from them, because they could care less what you believe. It's going to come from the fundamentalists, the ones who feel that because you don't believe in the Trinity, you are a cult. If you don't believe in hellfire, you're going there, and we're going to send you there early by burning you at the stake or something like that. All right, we'll stop with that chapter right there. Like we say, we're only touching on some of these points. Chapter 7, the nations assembled and the preparation of the elements. This is the chapter we are currently in our studies. Brother Russell points out that we're not talking about a literal gathering of people to literal Armageddon, but that the world is being gathered in many different ways. They're being gathered through travel, communication one with another, telegraph in Brother Russell's day, and we know that our modern communications far outshine the what we call them primitive now. They weren't primitive then. Communications they had in their day was satellite and TV and fiber optic cables and books. All these things are elements which can bring people together, not in a common geographical location, but in common interest and in common activity. Various desires and movements are now worldwide, whereas it was not possible then. Zephaniah 3:8 mentions that the purpose of the gathering is so that the Lord can pour upon the nations his indignation. So there needs to be some kind of a gathering. All right, but as far as the preparation for the elements, we're now talking about some of the forces which are going to drive the masses into the desperation which will lead them into Armageddon. And we mentioned before that there were some that would be heaping great treasures while the poor get poorer. And in Brother Russell's day, the Industrial Revolution had caused this to happen to a great extent. Men were falling from losing their jobs. Labor was at a premium. There were so many workers, you could afford to cut the wages in half. If you don't like it, somebody out there who wants to eat is going to take that job. And so you had a pressure upon the people and a widening between, on the one hand, people whose daily incomes would even today be excessive yearly incomes for us after inflation, and those who barely earned enough to even survive, and those that actually were starving to death in those days. We know that historically this condition was actually ameliorated a little bit, that with the rise of unions and labor laws and that, the bosses could no longer oppress their workers nearly so badly. But it's interesting. Sister June McNabb in our class brought an article from the Wall Street Journal. I didn't get the date, but it's in October of 1986. And what it showed was that at the present time, there is a growing gap between those that are rich and those that are poor. And therefore, this pressure that Brother Russell saw in his day, where the poor would say, this is not fair, is once again happening. In the financial world, we have what is known as the law of supply and demand. If something is in great supply, you have to cut the prices. If people aren't buying cars because there's too many of them, you've got to cut the prices. This, of course, hurts the auto industry, but the people who usually get hurt by the law of supply and demand is the person on the bottom, the common laborer. Brother Russell mentioned three things in his day that were causing strong pressures on the common person that would make him discontent. One was machines. The displacement of workers by machines. Why? Well, it throws them out of work. They still need to eat. And when they're out of work, now there's more people to fill those jobs. There's greater competition. So some other employer would say, well, if I cut your wages and you don't like it, this other person who's out of a job, he's going to be happy to take that job. Very basic principle. Another is the... We see that also today. It's a continuing thing, and it will come in waves. Another is that women entering the workforce as a pressure driving men to Armageddon. How so? Well, number one, you're increasing the number of workers. And we can bring that up to today, that in today's society, women have entered the workforce in greater numbers and greater percentage than at any time in the past. What happens? There's more workers to fill those, especially the bottom jobs. It also gives the employer a little advantage. He can say, I now no longer have to pay you enough to support a family, because both you and your wife should work. That's an expectation of the employer, so that no longer would we have a stable family existence. The women are now working instead of raising their families. And of course, the effect has been on the children. This is a very modern phenomenon, and it's the same as what Brother Russell had in his day. And of course, the last thing is foreign competition, because foreign competition removes jobs from your shore completely. And all this does is it creates large numbers of people unemployed. We currently have a relatively good employment scene, but we also know that it's cyclical. It goes up and down. And one of these times, as it goes down, the crash will come. We're going to leave that chapter here. I see we've been taking too much time on it. Chapter 8, The Cries of the Reapers. This is an interesting chapter because a lot of brethren are left in the dark as to what is Brother Russell talking about. He talks about the produce of the farmer not being able to be sold at a good price because of the demonetization of silver. What in the world is the demonetization of silver? And he goes into quite a few pages explaining how, you know, the effects here and there. Basically, what the demonetization of silver is that at one point you had gold cost so much and silver cost so much, and this is the way it is, period. If you want gold, it costs X, silver costs X. Therefore, different countries had a rate of exchange, that if you wanted to buy something in a silver country, you changed your gold into silver, went over there and bought your stuff, or going vice versa, you bought gold with your silver and came to this country and bought stuff. When they decoupled silver, what it allowed silver to do is the price of silver, instead of being fixed, could vary. And the first effect was that the price of silver dropped. When the price of silver dropped, a person in this country could say, well, now I can take my gold and I can convert it to silver at the prevailing rates. And now when I go over to India, my silver buys twice as much wheat as it does in the United States. So it was removing the money from this country and the market for our farmers. So what did the farmer have to do? He had to sell his wheat at below market prices, and he couldn't get enough money, and of course he was getting it in gold, to survive on. And the reapers are saying, wait a minute, why should I suffer because somebody has made this decision? There's a principle here, though. We're talking not about the specifics of silver and gold, but a monetary change. When you tie up a money by pegging it to a value, or you allow it to float, in any case, you have a monetary change. And who are the beneficiaries whenever money changes? They're the rich, the financiers, the ones who have control of the money. They're the ones that can shift their money from the stocks that aren't going to do well to the stocks that will do well. The poor person doesn't have that privilege. He is suffering at the bottom because of it. This is a pressure that the world of mankind always has. In today's society, more than any other, we have the rich in such control and so many intricate things that there's no possible way you and I can understand how the financial system works. We could not possibly benefit from it. Let's go. We're going to skip chapter 9. Its title is The Conflict Irrepressible, The Testimony of the Worldly Wise. And this is primarily quotations of various men in Brother Russell's day that saw the impending doom, and they didn't have the Holy Spirit. They didn't need the Holy Spirit to see it coming. We're going to go to chapter 10. It's an interesting chapter. It's entitled Proposed Remedies. Well, you got a problem? Let's have a fix. I'm that way. Any problem around the house? I try to fix up a solution to it. It aggravates Sister Marcia no end because she'd rather just live with it. I think about how I can fix it, but she knows that it's going to entail my time to fix it. All right. There were people in the world then trying to give some kind of fixes, fiddling, as it were, with the present system in order to make it better. We're going to just list a few of them, the ones that Brother Russell listed. First of all, prohibition and female suffrage.
Brother Russell didn't explain why they were put together. He just said that for some odd reason, they're put together. Prohibition, of course, was the elimination of liquor. There were some who felt that all the world's problems were caused by the drunkenness of man, literal drunkenness. When Prohibition came about, did that solve the world's problems? Hardly. He had just as many problems. And then he mentions female suffrage, and though he doesn't go into it, why? Well, female suffrage is basically giving vote to women, allowing the woman to vote. She hadn't, up until this time, had the power of the ballot. How would this help? Possibly, the idea would be to, you know, usually you think of men as the warlike people. Give the women the vote. Let them overrule the men on some issues. Did it happen? Did women voting stop any war? Did it even ease the conditions of the poor? It did not. The second possibility he suggests is sort of financial fiddling, and it was called free silver and protective tariff. Now, we already discussed the silver issue, and I'm not exactly sure what free silver advocated, but the idea was to create a more equitable financial system that would benefit everybody. And, of course, we realized that any benefit would only be temporary because the ones with the money, the financiers, would be the ones that would end up benefiting. And protective tariffs, the idea being that if you prevent foreign competition from coming to your soil, you save jobs in this country. Did it work? Well, first of all, maybe a little bit. But it also allowed trusts and businesses in this country to oppress the people. All of us are aware of the fact that when the auto industry had no competition, if you could work for the auto industry, you had it made. Because they took excessive profits off the cars, and the people from the janitor to the president made excessive wages. They abused their privilege. And it wasn't until foreign competition came that the prices of American cars could come down. A third solution, the next three solutions are political. Communism. That would be a nice solution. You take everything and make it common property. Everybody shares and share alike, right? And we have an example in the scriptures, Acts 2, verses 44 and 45. We're not going to actually read them. Where the early church in Jerusalem actually set up a communistic society where they had all things in common. Did it work? Even in the church. These are the spirit begotten of the Lord. Did it work? No. Later on, we find the Apostle Paul. What is he doing? When he travels places, he works so the brethren wouldn't be burdened. And he advocates in 1 Timothy 5:6 that every man should provide for his own. We also note that in, I believe it's Acts 5th chapter, that church at Jerusalem had troubles. It turns out that somebody thought that the widows weren't being properly taken care of. Whether or not this was so, we aren't told. But the deacons were then appointed to take care of the financial matters in the church because the widows were being neglected. So communism didn't work. Socialism is the fourth possibility. What socialism is, not current-day socialism, but the theory of socialism is public ownership. Okay, we don't have individual owners who can rack up immense personal profits, but public ownership. And not that everybody shares equally, but that each one gets according to what they do, but according to the dictates of the public, so that they can recognize value and they can pay for it. Well, and it's interesting that Brother Russell mentions, of all the possible solutions, this one most highly, sort of gives it the best review, as it were. And we see even in this country that Franklin Delano Roosevelt brought in many socialistic platforms that before his day didn't exist. Welfare, social security, governmental intervention into public works and various projects. Those were not a part of this country before Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And they are parts of a socialistic platform. The fifth one was nationalism. In nationalism, the nation owns everything and pays everybody equally. Another solution was called the single tax solution. It was rather radical. The idea is no ownership of land. The reason that there's such accumulation of wealth and inequities in the past is because people have owned land and they've taken advantage of it. If nobody owns the land, nobody can reap a disproportionate personal benefit. Instead, everybody takes whatever land they need, I'm not sure how in the world they'd ever figure out who gets what, and use it. And then they would pay a tax just on the land. And that's the only tax the country would take. And that's why it was called the single tax. On all of these possible solutions that have so far been mentioned, they can't work with present society. Mankind is too selfish. No matter how good this government is, you always have born schemers, those that fiddle with the loopholes and work their way around to get for themselves a greater personal gain than what they are entitled to. The seventh possibility that Brother Russell mentions, calls it an other, is let the churches rule. Why, the churches are benevolent institutions, and therefore they're there for the good of the people that they serve. Let them rule. Did it help when the churches ruled in the Middle Ages? It's called the Dark Ages, because the rule then was so bad that no time in history has equaled it. Even it would only work if the entire world were filled with nothing but saints. And then we see the example in the Jerusalem church that even then, as long as we have the flesh, there will be problems. The only hope, of course, is Christ's kingdom. Brother Russell does give a couple pointers at this time. What can we do now in the situations we're in? First of all, practice moderation and honesty in all of our dealings. Simple honesty. Just do what's right at all times, no matter what. Secondly, to be good stewards of what we have, whether it be great or small. There's nothing wrong with being rich, but if you have a lot of money and you're using it to oppress others for your own benefit, then it's wrong. Be a good steward of it. And if you have a very little, don't want more. Take care of what you have. That's what the Lord has given you. And the third, it was a rather practical thing. If your job has things in it that conflict with Christian principle, what do you do? Change jobs. There's lots of jobs out there. Going on quickly, the 11th chapter is entitled The Battle of Armageddon. We just wanted to point out the main topic in this chapter. Brother Russell goes through several of the symbols of Armageddon, but he also says that one of the pictures of Armageddon is the French Revolution. And he says that the same conditions prevailed in 1916, when the last foreword was written, as pertained then. First of all, the land. Two-thirds of the land in France was owned by the nobles and the clergy. They did not use it wisely, but used it to oppress the people. And we see that today, most of the wealth is owned by a small percentage. We heard a radio report that was criticizing those that said that 35% of the nation's wealth is owned by 1% of the people. Why, that's ridiculous. That's not true at all. It's only 25%. Monopolies. We supposedly have a free market system, but it's shackled. Companies getting together to control prices in one way or another, whether it be through governmental regulation or behind the scenes fiddling, or just the fact that I understand that if I undercut you, you undercut me, so let's not undercut each other. We don't have to say anything. We can raise our prices that way. And the second is, in France they had strict trade guilds, which equate with today's unions. The unions have become a money class in themselves, some of them. We had corrupt government. No need to say anything there. There was a loss of respect at that time for the monarchy and for royalty. What do we have today? There is little respect for anybody in authority at any level. Another problem was abortive reforms. People fiddling with the system to try to make what appeared to be benefits, but they actually did nothing to redress the actual wrongs. I like to use as an example this, the current tax reform. Anybody tried to figure it out? Has anybody here tried to figure out what your taxes are going to be afterwards? I don't know what yours are, but if you're in my income, even a little bit more, you're going to be paying more taxes because you're going to be in a slightly higher bracket than you used to be, and some of the deductions that maybe you used to take aren't going to be there anymore. I haven't figured out yet who it is that's going to be paying more taxes. The rich, maybe theoretically, because though they're in a lower tax rate, they've lost all their deductions. I read the things, and it's just a matter of the deductions are changed, and if you've got a good accountant, you can fiddle and you can keep them. Abortive reforms. There's also a time of political speculation. We have in our day many special interest groups. Let's do this. That will help solve our problems. No, let's do this. That will help solve our problems. We had the same thing in Brother Russell's day and in the French Revolution. We would discuss the Lord's great army a little bit here. It's described in Joel 2, verses 2 through 11. We won't read them. Brother Russell makes a few points. First of all, the Lord's great army is not the saints. It is not the church of God, the true church. Because they're a little flock. They're not using the sword of the Spirit viciously, but for good. The description is also not that of a national army. This is not one nation against another. Nor is it a mob that is just going unchecked. But rather, it is a very disciplined group that apparently masses of people with the same common goal that overturn the system. Overturn them. Brother Russell's thought was that many of those that had been trained in the armies of his day, and many of those that have been trained in the armies of today, have military knowledge. They know how to fight if necessary. And it wouldn't take too many of these to all get together with a common goal of, let's redress the wrongs, to create the condition of Armageddon. Of course, the Lord will have to ultimately destroy these people because they will come against Israel. One of the last features of the time of trouble will be what is called Jacob's trouble, where these masses will, after overturning the systems, will come upon literal Israel. And then God will have to fight and establish the kingdom. The next chapter, chapter 12, now we're getting back into the material that's more scripturally oriented, and we're going to mostly skip chapter 12. It's on the Lord's great prophecy. It's probably an entire discourse in itself. But we wanted to point out a few points in this, that in your study, that you know, these are the things that aren't usually mentioned by the brethren. There is one sign starting in verse 29, Matthew 24, verse 29, which talks about the darkening of the sun and the moon, and the falling of the stars as signs that are given after those days. Now, usually we interpret this symbolically. The sun, of course, is the gospel. The moon is the Mosaic law, and the stars are the teachings of the apostles. And that in this end time, that these things would be darkened. And we see this has happened. With the harvest truth being brought out, anything of truth that the nominal systems would have had is being darkened. They want to squelch the truth. On the Mosaic Law, we know a lot about the tabernacle now. And the purpose of the Mosaic Law, that also is rejected. It's dark. But we're going to point out that Brother Russell brings out some literal fulfillments of these signs. Brethren don't usually talk about these. In May 19th, 1780 was a dark day throughout all of New England where people couldn't even see in the middle of the day. Candles had to be brought out in order for people to see. And this darkness extended over most of New England and the Middle States and lasted until the middle of the night. Okay, the other thing, the falling stars. On November 13th, 1833, was a vast meteor shower that has apparently been unequaled in the annals of history. As a matter of fact, it's a Leonid shower, and I understand that tonight is the maximum of that same meteor shower. But in 1833, it was so intense that an area the size of the moon had hundreds of falling stars in it every second. It's like the whole sky was alight with little streamers of light. All right, now, why does Brother Russell mention these literal signs? Well, we have, in verse 34, the statement, "This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." Of what generation, what things are being fulfilled, when does the sign start? He makes the suggestion that the timing of this generation would start from the fulfilling of signs. And he makes a possible suggestion in a literal sense. Suppose we take this early date of 1780. Say a generation is 100 years. In Genesis 6, we suggest maybe 120 years. Well, if you added that, you'd come up with a date of 1880. By 1880, every feature of the kingdom had its incipient beginning. Is that a fulfillment? Possibly. Or if you take 1833 as the fulfillment, the falling stars, add 100 years, you get 1933 or 120, 1953. Obviously, they were still in that period of time in Brother Russell's day. Could that have been a fulfillment? Possibly. Another possibility. From 1878, the beginning of the fig tree coming out, and the fig tree is a symbol of Israel. When you see the fig tree, what does it say? Learn the parable of the fig tree. When his branches get tender and putteth forth leaves. And Brother Russell suggested possibly the fig tree was the beginning of the nation. When did it begin? In his mind, 1878, with the founding of Petatikva. Up until 1914, the time when he expected all things to end was 36 and a half years. And that's literally close to a physical generation of today's time. We only point this out because this is something brethren usually don't talk about. We're usually focusing on Israel in 1848, and time since. But Brother Russell then follows with this statement, and it's a good reminder. But of that day and hour knoweth no man. And it's sort of a little caution that we have to be very careful not to make dates that aren't firmly connected in Scripture. There might be some validity to all these possibilities, but we don't want to force it. Well, brethren, we're going to skip the rest then. We would suggest this chapter is an excellent chapter. Read it over a few times because it's going specifically into the Scriptures, something that we haven't done as much in our discussion here. Chapter 13 is called The Establishment of the Kingdom, and it gives a brief timeline of what should we expect when. The kingdom actually began, in one sense, with the beginning of the gospel age. We have in Matthew 11:12 the statement that up till now, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence. And throughout the entire gospel age, the kingdom of heaven is suffering violence. The church is persecuted and put down. But eventually, we have the first actual work of this kingdom. In 1878, the gathering of the elect. This is a work of the kingdom. The kingdom itself does not wait for the completion of this work, but it starts at once. And the church engages in kingdom work before they are changed. Revelation 14:13. This kingdom is set up once again before it influences the world. And its work, part of the work of the kingdom, is to destroy the present evil world. So when we say the kingdom has begun, yes, the kingdom has begun. We can also say the kingdom has not begun because we're looking forward to the blessings of the kingdom. But scripturally speaking, the kingdom has begun in this sense. Under the picture of the seventh trumpet, the kingdom has two works. First of all, it takes its power and the reign begins. And secondly, judgment comes upon the world. These are kingdom works. Not until the... This is more a quote from Brother Russell. Not until the full end of Gentile times in 1914 should we expect the earthly kingdom to be set up. Of course, this is one that we realize is yet future. Brother Russell was not given the insight there. Thus we see, well, the beginning of the earthly phase would be with the resurrection of the ancient worthies, and we see that the